The same religion that's capable of hideous acts of destruction can also be capable of moments of healing, of restoration, and of hope.
But educate a girl, and you educate her entire family.
There is a son within every person.
When that anger sets in, write it. Write the letters, but don't send them. You never want to leave concrete proof of insanity.
Dear friends of the University of California, Santa Barbara, dear friends of Santa Barbara, I want to thank the University of California and Santa Barbara for inviting me to talk before you all. It represents a very high distinction for me. It really honors me. I shall comment on Mexico's present situation when a new presidential term is at the beginnings, and mainly on issues I consider relevant in the bilateral United States-Mexico agenda, which must be faced with a vision of two people sharing not only a common border, but a destiny, their present and their future. Openly discussing our common problems will help for a better understanding of Mexico and Mexicans from the point of view of the United States, and better understanding of this country and its people by Mexicans, so we can improve the complex and diverse relationship existing between our two nations. Last year, Mexico lived a highly competitive electoral process, marked by the contenders' confronted visions on its tight outcome. This confrontation remains and has extended to organizations and individuals pertaining to the left. It's difficult to predict what will happen, but I find Nobel Prize José Saramago's opinion, expressed in an interview in Guadalajara last November, as the most judicious and intelligent on what democratic and progressive people have ahead. He said, and I quote, "Some say López Obrador won. Others say he did not win. He did not win. The protest that followed, I considered it legitimate, natural, but I also say the time to protest is over. Now it's the turn of politics. There are enough representatives in Congress, more than enough, to make a strong opposition. There's a left in Mexico, but it is a divided left, polarized, in some cases confronted, and that means going nowhere. I'm not going to say what he has to do, but if I were in the place of López Obrador, I would try at least to organize the left in Mexico, to bind it together, to look for a consensus of the left, and there are 6 years ahead, no more, no less, to prepare for the 2012 victory. Now it's the turn of politics, but of very conscious politics, very serious, passing over personal interests or injured prides. Interest now must focus on the Mexican people." End of the quote. I share Saramago's point of view. The main task of progressive forces, those commonly called the left, passing over the present political actors' individual interests and decisions, is to leave differences aside and confrontations of the recent past behind, and make an effort to put into practice a policy of unity. Unity starts by being open to discuss, elaborate, and present a common proposal regarding topics as electoral reform, energy policies, an economic policy to grow, develop, and create jobs, a social policy to progress in equality and put an end to marginalization and exclusion, the revision of the Federal Pact, and a proposal of constitutional reforms in the perspective of 21st century Mexico. Democratic and progressive forces, when seeking agreement on a common proposal, will have to be very, very well aware and very conscious. Mexico's new government is a government that will resort to any resources at hand to make its positions prevail. A government stemming from neoliberal continuity as a conservative force, as may well be seen, for example, in the regressive view on HIV/AIDS, a punishment of God according to a high official of the health department, or the unnecessary confrontation with Latin American governments, when the president declared, nobody will expropriate absolutely nothing in Mexico, in a clear allusion to Bolivia and Venezuela, making of nationalization and privatization dogmatic and not circumstantial issues or decisions, or the president of the PAN's boastful and bellicose declaration, when assuming the presidency of the Christian Democrat Organization of America, saying they will seize power and displace leftist governments of Latin America, unnecessarily antagonizing with governments having a friendly attitude towards Mexico. North America's free trade agreement, NAFTA, became in force 13 years ago. Cold figures could make us think that every party has benefited from it and all three are fully satisfied. Reality is quite different. 13 years after NAFTA became in force, results have been good for Mexico in certain areas, bad or very bad in others. In a decade, for example, trilateral trade has more than doubled. It increased 117%, and Mexican exports have more than tripled, going from $52 billion in 1993 to $165 in 2003, which may be seen as a positive impact of NAFTA on Mexican economy. But most of those exports correspond to foreign-owned maquiladoras established in Mexico and to internal transactions of transnational corporations which own the maquiladoras, not to what we could properly call exports generated by Mexican economy. Maquiladoras established in Mexico up to now, mainly in the border regions, represent a temporary relief to pressures on employment, but they keep wages well below, representing about a tenth those American workers get with equivalent jobs, and these industries have not integrated to Mexican economy, so we can say, in general, they haven't been a factor to create stable and fairly paid jobs, improve living standards, or rationally integrate our productive chains. It's easier to correctly appreciate Mexico's situation if we consider that in 1983, of every export dollar, 88 cents corresponded to national inputs, labor, services, raw materials, parts, components. In 1994, this figure fell to 42 cents, and today it may not reach 25. In 2000, Mexican exports reached their historical maximum, $166 billion. In 2003, they showed a small 0.7% decrease. Excluding oil, this figure goes up to a 2.2% decrease, and if maquiladora exports are not considered, for as I said before, they are mostly internal transactions of the corresponding corporations, we find Mexican exports fell 17% between 2000 and 2003. In agriculture, opening seriously affected cereal, bean, vegetable oil, sugar, milk, and cattle producers. Even if it must be recognized, vegetables, cement, beer, tequila, and fruits like mango, avocado, guava, lemon, and blackberry, among others, have gained new markets. We are now facing a new problem. In 2008, according to NAFTA, the border will totally open to grain imports, corn, beans, wheat, with a serious negative impact on Mexican producers, as Mexico has been lacking since NAFTA was being negotiated, of a policy specifically oriented to modernize its agricultural sector, and particularly to pay attention to diversify and increase production and productivity in those regions where grains are now grown. On the other hand, we must say NAFTA is the only free trade agreement in the world which liberalized the trade of agricultural products. Mexico has subscribed more than 10 agreements since 1994, and none of them considers the liberalization of agricultural products. Considering the effects of opening our borders and Mexico's social and economic conditions, there's the need of revising NAFTA according to the terms established in the agreement itself and to Mexican legislation, in those areas or in regard to those products in which there exists damage or risk of damage to national production, which can be clearly demonstrated considering the fall of agricultural products, the thousands of bankruptcies of industrial and service businesses, the decrease in the population's income, the abandoned fields, and the increasing migration. We may well say NAFTA is exhausted and gave already all it could give, so the Mexican government should propose its two NAFTA partners the signature of a trilateral cooperation addendum, which would commit the three parties in a cooperation effort not only in trade, but also in social areas, production infrastructure, having as its main goals the elimination of social differences and economic asymmetries through the creation, among others, of mechanisms like special funds to invest in development, following the European example, to give reality to these new policies. But trying to find a definitive, a more lasting solution, I would bring up the proposal I made when NAFTA negotiations were going on in 1990-1991, of an agreement not only on free trade and between the three North American nations, but an agreement on development and compromising all the nations in our continent, that is, with a much broader focus and considering the creation and utilization of mechanisms like investment funds to reduce economic and social asymmetries and promote growth, a social charter comprising labor rights and conditions, and a comprehensive commitment on environmental issues. I still believe this could be the best way to build a much fairer relationship among the nations of our continent and a way to reduce and finally stop irregular migration, opening and offering opportunities in every country for every country's nationals. Energy policies are another key issue in our relations. As time passes, oil is becoming scarcer and more expensive, and too little is being done, even in the most developed countries, to substitute the energy basis of world economy and social life, so fuels massively consumed derived from other sources different from hydrocarbons. Very recently, the U.S. government has announced the compulsory use of non-fossil fuels, but its wide use will take time. In any case, the United States is the most important oil consumer in the world and would like, as any other country, to be assured of its long-term supply. U.S. commercial and technological policies with this aim have been highly aggressive, supported by strong political pressures and time again, imposed by armed force and military action, as we saw during the Gulf War in 1991, not long ago in Afghanistan, and at present in Iraq. Mexico's oil production has entered a declining phase. Cantarell's production, the most important deposit under exploitation, fell 200,000 barrels per day and will continue falling in the following years, from a little over 2 million barrels per day in December 2005, it will reduce production to about 800,000 barrels by 2012. Mexican proven oil reserves, exploited as they are now, will last for 11 years, a terribly short time. Besides increasing exploration to find new deposits, Mexico should implement an oil policy with the priority of reducing to zero in the shortest possible time crude oil export and substituting the income it generates by the export of refined products and petrochemicals produced in Mexico. Mexico is producing 3.28 million barrels per day and exporting to the U.S. 1.6, which represents 14% of the U.S. total crude oil imports, not a negligible amount, which in the near future will have to be substituted from other sources, for as I said before, Mexico's oil production is already in a declining phase, and Mexico will have to meet with priority its internal demand, which has been steadily growing. These contradictory positions and needs of our countries must be conciliated so a fair and beneficial solution to both parties may be found. This is today one of the most important challenges in our bilateral relations. Mexico and the United States share a border 2,000 miles long, relations of great diversity, and above all, a lasting friendship, even if it hasn't always been easy and comfortable to be the neighbor of the most powerful military and economic nation in our present world. During this long and complex relationship, majority sentiments and goals of our peoples have generally coincided, not necessarily finding the same coincidence with their respective governments. The most valuable relation, and we can add, the most valuable exchange between our countries is direct human relation. 1 million Americans and Mexicans cross daily our borders, people who travel for business, work, or pleasure from one country to the other, families living across the border, and the most relevant, labor relationship, which provokes the most intense migratory flow to this country, and one of the most important migratory flows in the world. At least 3 million migrants have crossed the border in the last decade to work, and most of them to establish permanently in the United States. Population of Mexican origin in the United States reaches already 25 to 27 million, who are sending over $25 billion annually as remittances to Mexico, one of the most indicative, shameful, and worrisome facts of Mexican social situation, as it shows incapacity and lack of will by the government to solve in Mexico the life problems of millions of Mexicans. Labor migration is, with no doubt, the most serious and complex human problem we share, which today can be clearly seen by considering, on the one hand, the very important public discussions on both sides of the border, with the participation of very relevant people and fundamental institutions in the lives of our countries, and on the other, by the popular mobilizations in favor of immigrants' rights taking place all over this nation. In recent times, around 400 bills related to migration have been presented and are being discussed in state legislatures, about 40 in California, over 30 in Arizona, and more than 20 in Colorado among them. Those bills deal with matters as opening or closing education, housing, libraries, food stamps, hospital services to immigrants and their families, and the creation of new border police corps. In December 2005, the city of Manassas, Virginia, issued an ordinance criminalizing grandparents, uncles, nephews who share residence with any irregular immigrant, and sent an army of inspectors to the Latino neighborhoods to identify those houses and apartments which, quote, menace the spirit of the zone, where irregular Hispanics and relatives crowd to share the pay for the rent of their precarious housing. The State of Georgia Congress passed in 2006 one of the hardest laws on immigrant population, reducing immigrants' rights, charging them with the payment of direct taxes they were already paying in direct taxes through their food, housing, and services, and criminalizing employers for hiring them. Georgia is the state which has been receiving the highest number of irregular immigrants during the last 5 years. 10 years ago, there were almost no immigrants in Georgia, but when there was the need to build installations for the 1996 Olympic Games, federal U.S. authorities found labor was scarce and, in a very subtle manner, asked Mexican authorities to channel undocumented workers to Atlanta. After the Olympics, most of those workers decided to stay, and today Georgia is the second state for the remittances sent to Mexico. The same phenomenon is taking place in New Orleans after Katrina. President Bush, addressing the nation on several occasions, made migration issues the most important part of his messages. And migration was one of the main themes discussed in the North American Summit held in Cancun last year. The U.S. Congress received in 2005 at least three transcendent bills related to the migrant population in the U.S., which will have strong and important impacts if fully or partially approved and implemented: the McCain-Kennedy bill in the Senate, and the Kilcornyn and the Sensenbrenner bills in the House of Representatives. The Sensenbrenner bill, the most aggressive, racist, inhuman, unfriendly, and even unrealistic of several presented in Congress, proposed to extend the existing fences on our border for around 700 miles, to criminalize 8 to 11 million irregular Mexicans residing and working in this country, and some more of other nationalities, to reject any possibility of legalizing the residence of irregular foreigners already in the U.S., consider a crime and not only a civil violation, the illegal entry to this country, make felons those who assist irregular immigrants, and to establish the obligation for employers to verify the legal status of their potential employees. This bill passed in the House of Representatives, but not in the Senate. But other proposals have been approved, and barriers to control irregular immigration have been or are being built as part of Operation Gatekeeper in California, Operation Holding Line in Texas, Operation Safeguard in Arizona, or as a result of Hunter's amendment to the Sensenbrenner bill, approving the fencing of 698 miles, or the Senate's resolution S-2611 to build 370 miles of triple-layered fencing and a vehicle fence in different points of our common border. As a reaction to anti-immigrant laws, several cities in California, Maywood, Huntington Park, Pomona, Downey, Bell Gardens, and Cudahy, all of them in Los Angeles County, created the Sanctuary Cities Coalition, where employers are not considered criminals for employing irregular immigrants, or local police is authorized not to cooperate with federal authorities to arrest immigrants. On April 7, 2006, students and their parents held a demonstration before the Los Angeles Unified Scholar District demanding the region to be declared a safe zone. Mexico has been very sensitive to abuses by employers and authorities which nullify labor and human rights of Mexicans as workers and residents in this country. To this purpose, and to efface the conflictive aspects of illegal immigration, the Mexican government has to vigorously demand from American authorities full respect and efficient protection to Mexican workers' rights, and develop, in close collaboration with Mexican society, wide and vigorous actions so the U.S. government, and especially U.S. society, recognize the valuable and indispensable contribution immigrants and, in a vast proportion, irregular laborers give to the progress of this nation through their work, their taxes, their culture, now evident all over the nation. If we are objective and rational, if we really want to find effective solutions to problems migration poses on both sides of the border, we have to understand and accept, against vested interests or anti-immigrant and pro-war groups in this country, in the first place, that irregular immigration, border security, and the fight against terrorism is not one and the same problem, but different separate problems which have to be faced in different manners, with different means, in different ambits. Terrorism problems in the United States have nothing to do with the diverse and intense relations this country has with Mexico or the specific problems of our neighborhood. Terrorism stems from unfairness in world relations, asymmetries in development, from social injustice and poor education, from oppression and lack of democracy. The threats of terrorism will not disappear by restricting or hardening the rich and varied relationship existing between Mexico and the United States, but when a fair world order exists and egalitarian and democratic national systems prevail. The United States needs migrant workers who arrive from all over the world. But as everybody knows, most of them have around 500,000 every year from Mexico. U.S. economy and social life would paralyze in their absence and without their contribution. Mexican irregular immigration to the United States is a consequence of a stagnant economy, of increasing social polarization, the loss of jobs and the exponential growth of unemployment, of the abandonment of the Mexican state's social responsibilities, and will have definitive solutions through specific measures, very different from those considered to combat terrorism, some to be applied in this country by American authorities and American society, others in Mexico by Mexicans, some others sharing responsibilities and decisions, and enforcement on one or the other side of the border. And we have to be well aware, shared responsibility and collaboration from both sides are indispensable to give fair and definitive solutions to those problems. We have to begin by facing reality, and I would like to focus on the regular entry of 500,000 Mexicans every year to this country, and the presence of 8 to 11 million Mexicans who could be considered irregular immigrants in the United States in a universe of 27 million people of Mexican origin. In this regard, does anybody sincerely believe it is possible to criminalize and expel or deport those millions of people, those millions of workers from this country? What would be necessary in manpower and legislation to find and identify those criminalized immigrants, to concentrate them where, to organize their deportation, how many buses, trains, planes should be needed to move them away, how long would it take, how and by whom would they be substituted in what they are doing of useful and beneficial to this country? Even if fascist and unrealistic, in some way we must be grateful to Representative Sensenbrenner for his bill, for it triggered very important and positive actions in this country. Millions of people have taken conscious and mobilized all over the United States against unjust and inhuman proposals which impair the rights of millions of people, demanding recognition and solidarity to those immigrants who work for the progress and benefit of this country. As a first reaction to this bill and the thousands demonstrating in the major cities of this country, President Bush urged Congress to approve a broad migratory reform and recognize, quote, "Nobody should pretend immigrants are a menace to the identity of the United States, for immigrants have modeled the identity of this nation," end of the quote. Reacting to the same proposal, the California Senate approved resolution SCR 113, supporting the May 1st, 2006 boycott, the most extraordinary mobilization the world witnessed all over this nation, and recognizing the very important contribution immigrants give to this country. $4.5 billion as state taxes in California and $30 billion of federal taxes. During the discussion of this resolution, Senator Gloria Romero said each migrant in California contributes with over $2,600 to Social Security, and it was necessary to recognize in our economy we must depend on migrant participation. And Judge Consuelo Marshall from the District of Los Angeles Superior Court considered anti-constitutional the ordinance forbidding workers to ask for a job in the streets of the city of Redondo Beach, California. Demonstrators in large metropolis and small towns last May only demanded fair and humane solutions to the problems irregular immigrants face from day to day. So we can see people's mobilization in solidarity with immigrant workers is rendering results. Let's hope the U.S. Congress, authorities, and society face and handle migration issues with fairness, social sensitivity, and realistically, and reach definitive solutions. No problem will be solved by extending and building higher or enforced steel fences, by hardening the border, increasing the number of Border Patrol agents, or by letting Minutemen loose and protected with impunity. Americans and Mexicans, authorities, congressmen, academics, civil organizations, political parties, must sit together, discuss, gather information, hear from all sides and all kinds of opinions, analyze, think together, with the firm decision of finding realistic, comprehensive, and fair solutions to irregular immigration problems. Our commitment is to make fairness rule our relations. A fair present for both our nations will assure a much better future for both our peoples. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cardenas. Before we open the floor to questions, Mr. Cardenas has graciously agreed to take questions from the floor. He's agreed to answer a couple of questions first. And I'll begin with some of the questions that were given to us by some of the students. The legitimacy of the Mexican presidency was compromised in these last elections. The last time we saw such a loss of legitimacy was, of course, the 1988 presidential election in which you were a candidate. Despite popular support, you opted to act differently than your successor, López Obrador. Could you please explain any similarities and differences between the events of 1988 and 2006, and why you opted not to create a campaign such as López Obrador's Por el Bien de Todos in 1988?
Well, I think that elections in 88 and last year are very different. In the first place, in 1988, the opposition, what was called the National Democratic Front, formed by several political parties and social and political organizations, had no resources, very, very scarce resources, no means for propaganda, to support campaigns of the candidates for the Senate, for the Congress. The opposition had no access to media. I was talking this afternoon in Professor Sarah Klein's class, and I was telling the students that during the 8 months of campaign in 1988, I had only two interviews in television with national coverage, and both interviewers were very aggressive with me in those interviews. So the opposition had no access to media, particularly to television. We were not organized. The National Democratic Front, even if it united, four political parties, registered political parties that could present candidates, and about 10 different organizations participated. It was a very loose organization. What was decided in the group that coordinated the activities of the National Democratic Front didn't pass to the base of those organizations. It was difficult to transmit any instruction and to, in consequence, to organize any national mobilization or any national action in 1988. In 2000, the parties that formed the Coalición por el Bien de Todos, the PRD was the main axis of this coalition, had an important subsidy from the government, as every other political party in Mexico, had access to television and radio through interviews. Candidates are usually invited to participate in different programs and to be interviewed in different television and radio stations. They had resources to pay for time in the media, The PRD has been a political party since 1989, so the party has a much better, much more solid organization than the one the National Democratic Front had in 1988. So these are, I would say, main differences of the coalitions participating in one election or the other. On the other hand, in 1988, the electoral authority was absolutely controlled by the government. It was presided, Federal Electoral Institute was presided by the Secretary of Gobernación, of government. Now it's an independent body that heads the Federal Electoral Authority. That makes a big difference. In 1988, the votes were not counted. In 1988, the votes of 45% of the voting sections were not counted. They were, and this is a confession made by President de la Madrid in a book he published about 2 years ago. He says in that book that he instructed the Secretary of Gobernación to give the figures of this election as aggregate figures, and this means that the votes of 45% of the voting sections of the country were never counted, they were invented. And in 2006, the votes were counted. Everybody could follow the counting of the votes. I consider, regarding this specific point, that it was a big mistake, a big political mistake of the previous government not to accept to count again, to recount the votes, vote by vote, because this would have given much more security to the results. I consider that the results that were made public as the final outcome of this election is the correct outcome, but I consider a mistake not to have accepted to recount the votes, because this would have given much more security and, in a way, much more legitimacy to the government that was resulting from this past election. In 1988, we had to make a decision what to do after the government was imposing a new president and a new government. As I said, we had a very loose organization. It was difficult to mobilize nationally and simultaneously, and this is what I believe could have changed things, a national mobilization simultaneous all over the country. That was not possible. We tried it, we intended to call for this kind of mobilization, but we could not, we didn't arrive to it. And, we had to decide. Some say, we had to call for a revolution, for a rebellion against the government, but we were not prepared. A revolution is not made just because you want to do it. You have to prepare it, you have to organize, you have to gather arms, and we didn't have even slingshots, so it was not a matter of I want to do this or I want to do that. We had to face reality, and what we found as the solution at that time was to call for the organization of a party. We would have liked that all the organizations participating in the Democratic Front would have joined us in the project of a new party, but that was not possible. Only one of the parties that were part of the Democratic Front joined this new project. The others didn't. They lost their registration in the next election, 1991. So what we found that could be possible was to organize a political party, and that's where the PRD, the Party of Democratic Revolution, comes from. In this 2006 election, as I said in this declaration of José Saramago, I consider that what should have been done is to impose to an agenda. The election, the presidential election, was a real tie. In 15 million votes for Calderón, 15 million votes for López Obrador, the difference is 250,000 votes, about 0.5% of the whole vote in this election. And I think that this tight election could give, or would have given, the opportunity and the possibility of imposing important points of the national agenda. And this is not happening through the decision taken by the coalition Por el Bien de Todos of recognizing López Obrador as the legitimate president with a legitimate cabinet and trying to organize a support for this legitimate government. I think this is a mistaken strategy. I think we have to give more time to see what happens. But I think that this effort will be eroding with time and losing the opportunity of influencing with much force, strongly, the national agenda. I think these are main differences between the election of 88 and the election of 2006.
One final question before you open it to the audience. In a recent talk, you mentioned that it was time to revisit the Constitution of 1917 and to potentially begin a dialogue to make certain changes to the Constitution, and that part of the job that your foundation that you have formed was to begin a dialogue to do precisely this. Do you mind elaborating on this sentiment?
Well, since 1917 up to now, the Mexican Constitution has suffered or has had about between, that depends on who gives you the figure, but between 400 and 600 reforms. Some of them contradictory, and some of them, some of the recent reforms, going radically against the revolutionary spirit of the 1917 Constitution. So we have been calling, different groups have been calling, to make a revision, to rethink our federal pact, go to the roots, go to the beginning, and start the discussion, a process of revision and discussion of our present constitution and what are the main changes it should have. This is a process that is, well, we expect to start it in a few weeks, a few months, that we can discuss the needs of new rights, the needs of the discussion if Mexico should continue being a presidential regime or a semi-parliamentary regime, changes in the judicial power, what are the las facultades, los
the rights
or the areas of action of the federal government, the state government, the municipal governments. We want to open a very, very wide discussion on a new constitution so we can recuperate the spirit of the 1917 constitution, not copying it mechanically or not only restoring some of its previous articles, but going to a national discussion and a national revision and decide if these reforms are to be considered by the present Congress, by the Congress the existing Congress, or if it should a constituent Congress should be convened. These are discussions, and these are some of the questions that have to be discussed and decided if, as I expect, we go to discuss and present a new constitutional project to the country.
Thank you. If there are any questions from the audience, I'd ask you to please form two lines. There's another microphone there and one here. And to request that you please keep your questions short, no comments, and please, he has opened it up to the floor. You can come out and form lines.
Señor Cuauhtémoc, buenas noches. I have a great deal of respect for your career as a politician, and tonight I want to thank you because I'm here in the U.S., and I lived in Morelia, Michoacán, and you speak of lack of resources as a candidate for the presidency in 88. When you were a governor of Morelia, Michoacán, and you were part of the PRI party, you had plenty of resources. My question to you is, why did it take you 25 years to leave the PRI party? And thanks to your legacy in Michoacán, I left Michoacán, and most of the migrant workers who come here to California are from Michoacán. So my question to you is, what's going to be your legacy now that the political career is over? What's next?
Well, there were resources to work as governor, and resources in any government, I would say, are always scarce. But those resources were not used to support any campaign, and they were not used to support my campaign. They were used for public works, to meet social needs, to meet the needs and the commitments we had as governor with the state of Michoacán. We left the PRI, the Democratic Current, a small group that started to analyze and discuss the needs of reviewing and changing the public policies in Mexico in 1996-97. Well, we were confronted with the president, we were confronted with the whole political system in Mexico, and that's when the break came, the break between the Democratic Current and the government, the party of state regime. Why wait till 1986 or 1987? Well, I have no answer. Why was I born in 1934? I have no answer. That's when the circumstances coincided, and a group thought that we could confront the PRI. Then we decided to break with the PRI, and we decided to participate in an election in a very disadvantageous situation. That's what we did as the Democratic Current, and what I was saying a few moments ago about the 1988 election. I don't know what my legacy will be. I just try to be congruente. How do you say congruente?
Congruent. Eh? No congruente. Congruent?
Congruent between what I say and what I do. That's the only thing I could say.
Before you begin, seeing that there are a lot of questions, what we're going to do is have three people ask questions, and then he can answer them together, or else we won't be able to get to all the questions. So if you can make your question brief, and we can hear from everyone.
Okay. Muy buenas noches. Yo tengo dos preguntas. La primera es que hay rumores que se dice que porque usted no apoyó lo suficientemente al señor Emmanuel López Obrador, por eso esa fue una de las causas por las que perdió. La otra es que, por su punto de vista, ¿cuál es su punto de vista sobre las muertas de Ciudad Juárez, que son de las maquiladoras, que son de Estados Unidos? ¿Cree que se ha hecho lo suficiente por las muertas de Ciudad Juárez?
Her question was, the first one, there is a rumor that because you didn't support López Obrador's campaign, he lost. And the second question referred to the dead women of Juárez, if enough has been done and what should be done to avoid the death of the workers of the maquiladoras.
Gracias.
Buenas noches, señor Cárdenas. Gracias por visitar la Universidad de California. Es un privilegio tenerlo aquí. Mi pregunta es, en su opinión, y teniendo en cuenta la población de California, que es de alrededor de 36 millones, la población de México, el país entero, 103 millones, mi pregunta hacia usted sería, en su opinión, ¿cómo usted explica que la economía californiana o la sociedad de California es más próspera que la sociedad mexicana, teniendo en cuenta esta gran diferencia en la población entre California y México, simplemente California, y teniendo en cuenta que cada persona, como individuos, tenemos una responsabilidad hacia nuestra identidad social, ¿qué usted cree que debemos de hacer como individuos? Gracias.
His question was, if California has a third of the population of Mexico, why is it that California is a much richer nation per se than Mexico with all of its equitable resources?
Hi, good evening. My question to you is, you called for a change of NAFTA through a trilateral agreement for the elimination of asymmetries, as you mentioned, both social and economic. And you mentioned that there's a need to follow the European example, which may help stop irregular migration patterns. I was hoping that maybe you can talk a little bit about how that European example plays out and how applicable it is in regards to responding to these economic and social asymmetries.
Bueno, I'm going to answer the questions in made in Spanish and Spanish, if I may.
And I'll do simultaneous translation.
La elección del 2006 la pierde la coalición por el bien de todos por 250 mil votos. Yo solo puedo haber representado un voto. No 250 mil.
Okay. He said the coalición por el bien de todos lost by 250,000 votes. I only had one vote.
Por otro lado, yo haría una pregunta. Cuando inicia formalmente la campaña, la coalición por el bien de todos tenía en las encuestas un voto potencial del 50-52%.
When the Coalición por el Bien de Todos campaign began, it had
50-52%.
It had 50-52%.
¿Por qué en el curso de la campaña se cae de 50% or 52% a 35%. Yo no tengo respuesta para eso.
During the campaign, it fell from that high percentage of 52% to 30-35%. I don't have an answer for that.
El caso de las muertas de Ciudad Juárez, bueno, yo ahí sí coincido en que hace falta una mayor y más responsable investigación y una acción preventiva mucho más enérgica y mucho más eficiente que lo que se ha podido tener hasta ahora. No tendría yo otro comentario a ese respecto.
With regard to the dead women of Juárez, I agree that there needs to be more prevention and more investigation with regard to these deaths. And to the moment, I don't have any more comments on that.
En el caso de la situación de México, de por qué es más próspero la economía de California y los habitantes de este estado que los de México, yo creo que ahí tendríamos que considerar factores internos y externos. Considero que en los últimos años, ya muchos años, pues quizá de 1940 o 50 para acá, ha habido desviaciones a un compromiso político que ha tenido consecuencias en los niveles de vida y en las oportunidades de desarrollo de México.
With regards to the question about why California's economy is much stronger than Mexico's as a whole, we have to consider both internal and external factors. In Mexico, since the 1940s and 1950s, there has been a series of moving away from the projects of industrialization.
Por otro lado, no podemos desconocer factores externos que también han influido, es decir, malas decisiones internas, factores externos y también una dificultad o imposibilidad para participar la gente, los ciudadanos, en las decisiones de gobierno y en las orientaciones de los distintos gobiernos a lo largo del tiempo.
In regards to the internal factors, there have been bad internal decisions. Among these, the lack of the general population to participate in the decision-making process of Mexico.
No podemos, por otro lado, desconocer que la economía de California es una economía muy próspera, pero que no puede separarse de su pertenencia a la economía más poderosa del mundo y al país que pues ha echado mano de todo tipo de recursos, unos éticos y otros no éticos, para mantenerse en esta posición.
We can't deny that California is a prosperous state, but we also have to add that it's part of one of the most prosperous nation in the world that has maintained that powerful stature through ethical and non-ethical means.
In the case of NAFTA, I consider that if we followed the example of the European Union. The European Union, when a decision was made to create the European Union of 15 nations, those most developed nations created investment funds to improve the economy, the infrastructure, to modernize the economies of those less developed countries. This was the case of Portugal, Spain, and Greece in this first stage of the European Union, the stage of 15 nations. And there were important, there still are important investments of the most developed European countries in the less developed ones. And well, this reduced the differences between the economies of those countries. This opened possibilities of improving social conditions. And I think that this kind of mechanisms should be adopted in NAFTA, so we could reduce the big difference, the asymmetries existing, social and economic asymmetries existing between Mexico on one side and Canada and the United States on the other. This kind of mechanism, a social charter, which should consider labor rights and labor conditions in the different countries, and also a comprehensive commitment on environmental issues. This we proposed since NAFTA was being discussed, and I consider it still a valid proposal.
Buenas noches. Yo le quería preguntar, bueno, yo recuerdo hace mucho tiempo que cuando uno chocaba en la Ciudad de México, le cobraban miles de pesos por daños a la nación. Mi pregunta es, ¿quién está pagando todos los hoyos que dejaron en Reforma y el más de un millón de tortas que se pagaron por 40 días, más de 40 días en el Zócalo? ¿Quién está pagando por eso?
My question has to... My question is in regard with, I recall that Mexico before, when you used to crash, you would have to pay a couple thousand pesos. So now I want to know what's happening with all the holes that were left on in Reforma. This is after the manifestations. And for the millions of tortas that were consumed during the manifestations, who paid for these?
Yo no tengo una respuesta. Podría yo imaginarme que una buena parte de esos costos los... absorbió el, los costos de bloquear tres meses el paseo de la Reforma, fueron absorbidos en parte por el gobierno de la ciudad, yo diría indebidamente desde un punto de vista administrativo, ético y político, y también una parte supongo que fueron absorbidos por la coalición, el grupo, el conjunto de partidos políticos que... encabezó y que realizó este bloqueo. No tengo constancia ni de una cosa ni de la otra, pero pues de algún lado tienen que haber salido esos recursos.
I really don't know where the funds were coming from to pay for the blockade that lasted 3 months on Reforma, but my I'm guessing that it was partially the city funds and also funds from the Coalición por el Bien de Todos. We're going to have three questions and then he can.
Bueno, no tenerlo aquí, ingeniero. Bueno, mi pregunta es, ¿cuál es el detonante psicológico que le hace falta al pueblo de México para llegar a alcanzar una afluencia tal que llegue a ser independiente económicamente hablando del resto del mundo?
The question which was also translated. What is the most important psychological element that Mexico needs to become a more affluent society and a more economically independent one from the rest of the world?
Good evening. My question is that you just compare the elections of 1988 with the elections of 2006, and you said that Miguel de la Madrid accepted around 10 years later that it was that he gave the order to not count the votes, so it was a clear fraud. You say that this election was just tight, but there is still like a 30% or more of the population who believe that it was a cheat election, that it was also a fraud. And maybe in 10 years, Fox is going to accept that. He said, like El Bester Gordillo, why you don't operate all this situation? So my question is, like, this 30% of the population, independently or you or Andrés Manuel López Obrador, support you during your campaigns in the past, and even in the 1988, and when you run for Mexico City, and then when you consequently run for president. And this is a huge part of the population that is also supporting López Obrador because they want to change, right? And you decide not to participate in the campaign. That might be okay or not, but you also decide not to participate. You decide not to participate practically keep like not saying what you think about the elections, and it seems that you don't support all that 30% or more of the people who wasn't happy with the election. So my question is why you decide not to support the people who support you before during the many years, and independently of if it was you or López Obrador, because the only aim is to change the country, not who is going to win the election. That's my question.
Así. No sé, desconozco cuál puede ser un detonante psicológico para lograr que México avance económicamente. Yo considero que tenemos que abrir más espacios de participación democrática, tenemos que perfeccionar nuestros sistemas políticos. No sé, si desconozco, repito, qué pudiera ser un detonante psicológico, pero sí creo que tenemos que avanzar y este es un esfuerzo que pues nos corresponde a todos. en mejorar nuestros sistemas de participación, mejorar nuestros sistemas en nuestra propia democracia, y creo que por ahí mejorando nuestra democracia y a través de ella logrando también una mayor equidad en el concierto mundial, podríamos tener mayores y mejores posibilidades de crecimiento económico.
I'm really not sure what the psychological factor or push to develop Mexico into a more enriched country in the world, but I do know that there has to be more open spaces for democratic participation for us to develop and better our systems of democracy in this way, opening venues for everyone to participate. And I didn't catch the last part, so for the Spanish impaired, I'm sorry.
The people in it's a large part of Mexico's citizenship that is still supporting the what we call the legitimate president or the legitimate government, believes that there was fraud in this 2006 election. Others, I include myself, considered that there was not a fraud, not a systematic fraud as the one we saw in 1988. As I said before, I think it was a big political mistake, big political error, not to accept the recounting of the votes. In about 5 or 6 months ago, I was criticized by a very important personality in our literature, Elena Poniatowska, and I made a public letter for her. And she had more or less the same questions, or she made more or less the same questions we just heard a moment ago, that why hadn't I participated more actively in this campaign? I consider that López Obrador's proposals in the campaign, what he presented publicly, did not correspond in many aspects to the principles of the PRD and the principles we had been supporting and promoting in Mexico. I didn't agree with the candidates who came from the PRI and had been participants in making the fraud in several local elections since 88 till almost 2005. I wouldn't say 2006, but 2005. There were several candidates for the Senate in the states of Hidalgo, of Coahuila, of Chihuahua, at least, that had been acting, and you can follow their political histories, I would say, acting against the principles that the main body of the PRD had been sustaining. I think that if we go, if we study responsibly López Obrador proposals, public proposals, not what he's saying after the election, after he declared himself as a legitimate president, those proposals did not represent what we had been struggling for many years. And this is giving a vote or participating in a political campaign or making commitment with any political cause was is not a matter of just of personal. It's not a personal matter. It's taking a political position, and I think that what he proposed did not represent a change, and this is why I was not actively participating in the campaign. As I said before, I gave my vote for the candidates of my party, but that was all I did in this campaign. But you cannot consider that participating in politics or committing yourself with any cause can be only a matter of a personal matter. For me, it's much more important to comply to your political principles, to your political commitments, and not just because maybe he supported me. He didn't support me, I can tell it very clearly. He didn't support me when I was running for the presidency, and he was running for the mayorship of Mexico City. It was very difficult to make him participate jointly with me in the campaign in the federal district. We had differences in those days. And well, that would be a personal matter. I wouldn't take that into consideration. I think that's more important to act according to principles, according to the commitments anybody may have in his political life. And that's why I publicly gave my positions in a very long letter written to Elena Poniatowska, explaining why was my attitude in 2006 as it was.
We'll have two more rounds of three questions.
Hi, I'm Michael Luna. First of all, I want to say that I'm very honored to be in your presence, and that you and your father have shown great humanitarian leadership in Mexico, and that Mexico lost out in a great opportunity in your leadership for, in 1988. My question is in regard to the world economy. It's getting to be more and more balanced, more competitive, with China now at 1.2 billion people. I think we would all agree it would be in Mexico's best interest to diversify and become less codependent with the U.S. economy. What is Mexico doing to become, to stimulate the domestic economy in relation to China, and how can Mexico get more involved in the business aspect with the 1.2 billion people of China?
Buenas noches, señor Obrador. Gracias por estar aquí con...
Es Cárdenas.
Cárdenas.
No importa, no importa.
Disculpa, acabo de regresar de México.
No hay problema.
My father is a mayor in one of the towns in Mexico. This past year, I visited various states in Mexico with the intention of getting a clear look at the Mexican politics. Mexican politics is not as prosperous as other democratic nations. One reason is because the Mexican constitution is very vague and outdated. It's not largely recognized as a resource for political guidance. It was practically paralyzed for 71 years during the pre-rule. Another reason is that the lower governmental division is operated under a system called customs and cultures, que en español es los usos y costumbres, a system where change is more likely to happen on a generational basis instead of a rapid political transition that is needed for any political advancement, and consequently it's left open for exploitation from big interest groups and big government. Mr. Cardenas, this is a system where more than half of the Mexican poor populations resides in. This being said, how does the PRD and Mexico intend to transition into a new era of politics and end the culture of corruption and never-ending political rivalries created by a stratified politics and establish a new concept of democracy? Thanks.
Do you want to take those two, or do you want to take one more? Una más? Okay, una más?
Good evening, nice to see you again. Article 76 of the Mexican Constitution, it states about a discretionary fund given to the president, la partida presidencial, which is a certain amount of money approved by Congress that the president can spend whatever way he wants without regards to accountability. In Cedillo's administration, this almost totaled $500 million. Is this one of the articles that you're looking to reform in your constitutional reformation project? Would this be something beneficial to take out?
Well, I don't know what the Mexican government is doing or planning to accelerate our economic growth and compete in better conditions with China and other nations in this globalization process we have been living for the last years. I'm sure that Mexico needs to grow more rapidly, to grow in a sustained way in a long term if we want to change present conditions, and give much more attention to social problems, poverty, creation of jobs, income of the largest population groups, etc. But I don't know what this government is planning to do. We haven't heard up to now, after 2 months of this new government, what are the plans of this government on the economy. We have been proposing from the opposition since several years ago the need of fiscal reform, the need of changes in our energy and in our oil policy, so Mexico can transform the oil that's now being exported in Mexico, and instead of exporting crude oil, export petrochemicals and refined products. We have been demanding to the government to give much more attention to the development of different regions where there are important natural resources, or where there is the possibility of promoting intense industrial development. But I don't know what the government is planning to do, and I don't know what specifically the government is planning to do to face the competition of Chinese products that are present in many ways in Mexico right now. I wouldn't accept that Mexico was paralyzed for 71 years. That's from the early 30s up to 2000. In those years, Mexico made a very important, the most important, at least in Latin America, agrarian reform. Oil was expropriated from the foreign companies. And we had a long period of economic growth for almost 40 years, with over 5 or 6% of the gross domestic product sustained. So I couldn't say that Mexico was paralyzed for 71 years. In the last governments, Mexico has moved backwards in many aspects, social, economic, political. And on the other hand, since 1988, important changes have occurred in our political life. We have better electoral system. We have an independent electoral authority. So I wouldn't say that the country is paralyzed. We have to do many things. We have to do changes in our public policies. But I wouldn't accept that the country has been paralyzed and everything that happens in Mexico is related with corruption. There's corruption in Mexico, there's corruption in this country. We have to fight corruption. We have to start fighting corruption from the top, like when one sweeps and stares. But I would neither consider that what we call usos y costumbres, the traditional uses of many communities, is a factor that makes Mexico move backwards. On the contrary, I think that we have to respect those traditions of Indian communities in Mexico, and these traditions have in many ways represented the survival of this of these communities as communities and the protection of their natural resources in many parts of the country. So there are positive aspects, negative aspects, and we cannot say that everything is good or everything is bad in Mexico. And I think that happens there, and that happens everywhere, and that happens here too. I have to read Article 76, as you said, because before there existed a secret una partida, a secret budget, I would say, that was decided only by the president, but that disappeared some years ago. I don't know what's the present text of Article 76 or the laws that regulate the secondary legislation, Article 76. But I can assure you that there are funds that are exercised by the president, but they are regulated by Congress, and there's not the possibility, even if I'm in the opposition, I couldn't accept that the president can use freely this amount that you said without being accountable to nobody. I don't think that this exists in Mexico, and this would be a very, very important point for the opposition to use it once and once again. And this isn't happening, and I think it doesn't happen because this is not exactly what this article establishes and how this part of the budget is regulated.
Okay, this is our final round, and we have time, I was just told, for only two more questions. So we'll take one for each side. For those of you who still have questions, if you can write them down, I will send them to Mr. Cardenas, and I'm sure he will answer them.
Thank you. I heard that during the 2006 elections, the indigenous peoples of Chiapas, so at least people who represent them, or claim to represent them, were calling for a boycott of elections. For boycott of the elections. They didn't want to give their vote to the right or the left or anyone. That called powerfully my attention because it reminded me of Peru in 1980 with the Shining Path, the call for boycott to elections, no parties. And so my question is, why the left, whether it's your party or López Obrador or whoever claimed to be the left, why the left was not able to rally around the indigenous people? Why this disconnect happened between the parties of the opposition and the indigenous people that didn't seem to feel themselves they were represented in the opposition? Or what is your take on this situation? Thank you.
And this is the last question.
Buenas noches y gracias por venir a hablar con nosotros. Y además, gracias por todo que usted ya ha hecho. My question for you is, I'd like to know what your thoughts are about President Bush's new proposal for a guest worker program.
Well, I really don't recall that the Zapatistas in Chiapas called to boycott the elections. They have always declared that the Zapatista movement is not an electoral movement, that they are not participating, but that they leave to the decision of any citizen participation in elections. I really don't remember that the Zapatista group in Chiapas called to boycott the election. They just said, we are not participating, and if anybody wants to participate, well, that's it's a personal or group decision, but we have nothing to say and nothing to do with those decisions. We are not participating, we're moving on other planes, we're moving to organize the people, and that's what I could say of the Zapatista movement regarding the elections. I don't know exactly what's the proposal made by President Bush regarding the guest workers program. I think this program can work positively regarding the workers that may come to the United States to work temporarily. I find it difficult if these workers were to stay for some time and then sent back to Mexico or to any other countries, because what we have seen here is that if those workers or those laborers come here, well, they would if they're working, they're meeting their needs, well, they'll try to stay here. And I think that if Mexicans coming to the States are about half a million every year, if this guest workers program keeps below this figure, well, the rest will still be trying to find the way to come here. And I think that the main problem is not the guest workers, but trying to develop a policy that stops migration, and that's one possibility would be the creation of these investment funds to improve conditions in Mexico and open opportunities in Mexico. And the big problem, I think, is what to do with the 8 or 11 million irregular or illegal immigrants that are already in the United States. That's, I think, the big decision this country has to make. And I think that decision will be the final, the real solution to immigration problem.
A small token from the History Department to thank you and to hopefully entice you to come back to Santa Barbara. Thank you so much for coming here.
I want to thank you all for your assistance and your participation and for giving me this opportunity of being here in Santa Barbara. Thank you.